Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show on prostate cancer. I'm Priya Menon, scientific media editor at Cure Talk, and along with the Cure Talk team of Sharad Khan and Chintan Patel, I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on prostate cancer. We will be moderating the call and bringing people live on the show. This is the 8th episode of the Cure Panel Talk Show and first Cure Panel discussion on prostate cancer. Our panel discussion broadcasts have received over 29,000 replays till date. Today's panel is very unique. Well, I'm calling in from India, where it's already the 29th, around 3:30 a.m. in the morning. Our co-host, Dan Zenka, Senior Vice President Communications at the Prostate Cancer Foundation, has called in from California. Dan was diagnosed with prostate cancer in 2010 at the age of 51, and you can follow Dan's prostate cancer experience on his personal blog, My New York Minute. Welcome to the show, Dan. On the panel, we have Terry Herbert, calling in from Australia. Terry is a prostate cancer survivor who has been on active surveillance for over 10 years and is also the founder of the website Yana Now, or You're Not Alone Now. We have Dan Hennessy calling in from Canada. Dan is a prostate cancer survivor and author of With the Snap of a Glow, which outlines Dan's prostate cancer journey. Gary Peterson, editor, MyelomaSurvival.com, has called in from Florida. Gary is a multiple myeloma survivor and part of a myeloma cure panel. A hearty welcome to all the panelists. The expert on the panel is Dr. Matthew Cooperberg, assistant professor of urology, UCSF, Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center, California. Dr. Cooperberg, on behalf of the Cure Talk team, I welcome you to the Cure Panel Talk Show. I welcome all the listeners to the Cure Panel Talk Show on prostate cancer. I would like to read out a couple of rules which would make your Cure Panel experience smooth. If you are listening into the panel through your phone as well as a computer, please mute or stop the online broadcast on your computer for better audio quality. Callers will be invited to ask questions at the end of the discussion. They can let us know by pressing 1 on the keypad and we will bring them online live. The topic for today's panel discussion is risk-stratified treatment and active surveillance in prostate cancer. I invite Dan Zenka to tell us all about the Prostate Cancer Foundation and his experience with prostate cancer. Dan, you're on air now.
Okay, thank you, Priya. The Prostate Cancer Foundation was founded in 1993 when there was very little research for prostate cancer going on. Since then, we've raised $530 million to fund innovative research to find better diagnostics and treatments for advanced prostate cancer. As a result, we're very pleased and very proud to say that the death rate currently is 40% less than what was once predicted. Ironically, after being here with prostate cancer for 2 years, I was diagnosed with my own case. It appeared at that time that it was an aggressive genotype of cancer. I underwent a radical prostatectomy, and the post-surgical pathology showed that the cancer had spread to my lymph system. So I then had 7 weeks of IMRT, or radiation therapy, and 2 years of, androgen deprivation treatments, which I'm just coming off of at this point. So I shared a lot of that on my blog, My New York Minute. At this point, though, it is my great honor to once again introduce Dr. Matthew Cooperberg. He is a distinguished physician scientist. In addition to the credentials you mentioned, he earned his doctorate in medicine and his master's in public health from Yale University. And we're very proud to say that in 2011, he was a recipient of a PCF Young Investor Award, which is a 3-year award specifically designated for a young investor investigating a specific area of prostate cancer. At this point, Dr. Cooperberg, I'd like to invite you to do an introduction, provide an introduction to the topic of risk stratified treatment and active surveillance.
Sure. Thank you very much to both Priya and Dan for the invitation to speak today. And I would really stress it really has been a tremendous honor to work with the Prostate Cancer Foundation and really express my gratitude for my own career and on behalf of all of us at UCSF and elsewhere for the support that the organization has given us over the years and really has made a tremendous difference for men diagnosed with the disease around the world. As Dan mentioned, the very good news in prostate cancer is that since the start of the PSA screening era in the 1990s, we have seen a drop in mortality rates for this disease of actually more than 40% by the most recent data. And this is not just the percentage of men who die with it. This is the age-adjusted population rate at the sort of highest epidemiologic viewpoint. And this is a time when men are living longer, they're dying less of cardiac disease. If anything, they should be more at risk of prostate cancer mortality. And yet we have seen this steady, inexorable decline in mortality rates. And this is a tremendous victory by any account. What exactly explains it remains pretty controversial, but the best analyses suggest that it is a combination of both early detection with PSA and better treatments, improvements in surgery, radiation therapy, medical therapy, et cetera. So how did we wind up from, you know, this, like I said, very good news with respect to prostate cancer? How did we wind up going from there to the decision by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force in 2012 to recommend against PSA screening? And we should remember that was not a recommendation to only screen some men or to screen for high-grade prostate cancer or to screen selectively. The recommendation was to screen nobody, ever. And I think it reflects a real disconnect between the way we think about the disease from the screening perspective and the epidemiologist's perspective and the way it actually has been managed in the U.S. And the problem is that prostate cancer kills more men than any cancer except lung cancer, and that is still true despite the improvements in mortality rates. However, it's actually a small minority of men diagnosed with the disease who actually die of it. Prostate cancer is extraordinarily common, even more than the published numbers would really suggest. You know, there's over 200,000 men who are diagnosed with the disease every year in the United States alone. But the actual prevalence is even higher. If you look at men who die in car crashes and things in their 30s, and we do an autopsy and look hard enough, we can find a couple of cancer cells in about 30% of men. You live into your 50s, it's about 50%. You live into your 80s, it's just about everybody will have a couple of abnormal-looking cells on their prostate if we look hard enough. Now, of course, most of these would never go on to cause any symptoms or any loss of life or any threat had they never been diagnosed. And many of them, frankly, probably shouldn't be called cancer because they don't behave like what we think of a cancer doing in the body. So our challenge has really been separating out which ones need treatment and, you know, which ones we can treat and continue to push the mortality down while avoiding overdiagnosis and subsequent overtreatment for the many, many men with low-risk prostate cancer. And we've changed the nature of the disease because of screening. You know, before the PSA screening era really took off and got underway, prostate cancer was often found at late stage. It would show up with symptoms of either urinary obstruction or ureteral obstruction or bone pain. And the majority of prostate cancers that were identified either were already advanced and incurable or had fairly high risk disease characteristics. And I'll get into more later as to what that really means to be high risk. Over the years, prostate cancer has become much more common because we've found more of them, but we've also seen this profound risk migration so that whereas before 1990, almost a quarter of prostate cancers were advanced or metastatic at time of diagnosis, now that number is about 2% or 4%, depending on which series you look at. And nearly half of all men diagnosed with prostate cancer have low-risk, relatively indolent tumors, which in many cases, again, would never cause any problems had we not gone looking for them. And again, the challenge for us as a treating community is figuring out which ones need to be treated and which ones don't. And it's actually, you know, you will sometimes hear, especially those opposed to screening, make these statements that we can't tell which ones need to be treated from which ones do need to be treated, and that's simply not true. There are a number of clinical parameters that we can look at to try to identify which prostate cancers are more aggressive and which are not. The first is actually, again, the PSA. You know, PSA is controversial as a screening test for prostate cancer, but it's actually a very good tool for risk stratifying a cancer once it has been diagnosed. We'd like to see the PSAs under 10, even more to see them under 6. Those are the ones we consider low, relatively low risk. PSAs in the 10 to 20 range or intermediate. Over 20, we start to think of them as somewhat higher risk. And, of course, men who have advanced disease can have PSAs in the hundreds and thousands. And actually, if you look, speaking of which, if you look at an unscreened population or a relatively unscreened population, you see a pattern which looks very much like the U.S. used to look. We've had this fascinating collaboration with a database in Japan, which is still a relatively unscreened population, though things are changing there with respect to screening. And it's a completely different story, a completely different situation. Most men there are still diagnosed with advanced prostate cancer with PSAs in the hundreds and thousands. So PSA is the first risk factor. The second is the Gleason score, and that is a measure of how the cells look under the microscope. When a prostate biopsy is done and the pathologists look at the tissue, they determine whether or not there is cancer, and then if there is, they assign a grade, and that's called the Gleason grade. And the Gleason grading system is a 1-5 grading system, but the standards have changed over time so that patterns 1 and 2 really don't exist anymore. So pragmatically, pattern 3 is relatively low grade and non-aggressive. Pattern 4 is intermediate, and then pattern 5 is high grade and more aggressive. But prostate cancer can be heterogeneous even within a given prostate and within a given tumor. And in many cases, what we'll see is a combination of patterns. We might see a tumor that's mostly pattern 3 with a little bit of pattern 4. Well, that gets called a 3 plus 4. Others will be mostly 4 with a little bit of 3. That gets called a 4 plus 3. So you'll often hear a Gleason score or a Gleason sum reported, like a Gleason 6 or Gleason 7. And that's you know, summing the Gleason like that is... gives us some information, but it also loses a lot of the detail because there's a big difference between the 4 plus 3s and the 3 plus 4s. We think when we see these tumors where the primary pattern is 4 or 5, those are the ones that seem to be more aggressive. Conversely, we're starting to realize that there's many prostate cancers which have just a little bit of pattern 4. So 3 plus 4s where only 5% of the cancer, for example, is pattern 4. Those often behave very much like the 3 plus 3s, the truly low-grade ones. And then finally, so we've got the PSA, the Gleason score, and then there are measures of how much cancer is in the prostate. So you can look at stage, which is just whether we can feel the tumor on a digital exam or whether we can see it on an ultrasound or an MR. But better than that, a better proxy for tumor volume is how much cancer there is on biopsy. So if we take a systematic biopsy of the prostate and take 10, 12, 14 cores, how many of those have cancer, and how much of the tissue is actually involved with cancer. So we can put those parameters together, things like the stage, the grade, and the PSA, and group patients into low, intermediate, high-risk groups. Or we can go one step better and use a multivariable model to really try to give a better, more accurate estimate of where a given patient falls on the risk spectrum. And there's many, many ways to do this. Perhaps the best known are the nomograms. There are tables, there are nomograms, there are multivariable risk grouping systems. There is a common, for anyone familiar with this field, there's a common misnomer, actually, which calls any multivariable model a nomogram. You know, a nomogram is really just a graphical representation of a model which statistically combines these different parameters, the PSA, the Gleason score, et cetera. And one way to summarize that information is with a graphical illustration. That's a nomogram. You could also do this as a series of lookup tables like the Parton tables. At UCSF, we developed the CAPR score, which is the Cancer of the Prostate Risk Assessment score, a number of years ago. This has now been validated in tens of thousands of patients around the world on 4 different continents. And again, this combines the PSA, the Gleason score, and the extent of biopsy involvement to give a 1 to 10 score, which is a risk stratification, which can predict prostate cancer outcomes with high reproducibility and reliability. and does so across different treatments, so across surgery, radiation therapy, and can predict both whether the cancer will come back after primary treatment and also give an estimation of what's the risk that that a patient will actually die of disease. Now, instruments like this, the Capra score, nomograms, et cetera, have about a 70 to 75% accuracy rate, depending on which specific cohorts you're looking at. And that's not bad in the spectrum of things. Of course, we're always pushing to do better, and the whole rapidly evolving field of biomarkers for prostate cancer is really intended to improve the accuracy. There was actually just a story in the New York Times about this yesterday, looking at the rapidly, really incredibly rapidly evolving field of biomarkers intended to improve risk stratification for prostate cancer. But the fact of the matter, again, is that we can do pretty well with the current state of the art. We can identify with about 75% accuracy which tumors are low risk and which tumors are high risk. The problem is that we have not done a very good job as a treating community in targeting treatments to the men who are most likely to benefit from treatment. So we have a number of studies now, not randomized trials, but a number of studies looking at surgery versus radiation therapy versus other interventions. And we do have two randomized trials looking at surgery versus no treatment for men with prostate cancer. And it turns out, if you look at the Scandinavian trial, which came out originally in 2002 and was updated in 2011, or more recently the PIVOT trial from the UCSF VA population, that men with low-risk prostate cancer in many cases do not need treatment, and they are no more or less likely to live a full life if they are treated or if they're not treated. Conversely, men with high-risk disease benefit tremendously from early treatment and are much more likely to die of prostate cancer if they're not treated. And it is worth remembering that this is often not, it's not the best way to go. It's a slow, painful process, dying of prostate cancer. And there are many endpoints that we seek to avoid in treating prostate cancer besides simply lowering the death rate. But again, if you look at the practice pattern across the U.S., we have not really targeted treatments the right way. We tend to overuse treatment for low-risk disease, and we underuse treatment for high-risk disease. There's a number of studies suggesting we should be using more surgery for high-risk disease, often as multimodal therapy. Many men with high-risk prostate cancer should get surgery and radiation therapy and systemic therapy. And frankly, this is no different from breast cancer, rectal cancer, other cancers, where we've known for many years that this is the answer. And yet, in prostate cancer, we still tend to have these debates about surgery versus radiation, focusing on low-risk disease, where the question is really about quality of life. Which brings me to the point about active surveillance. So active surveillance, we are increasingly recognizing, is an answer, if not the best answer, for many men with low-risk disease. And what this implies is that we can look at these criteria, the PSA, the Gleason score, et cetera, and predict with reasonably good accuracy which prostate cancers are unlikely to progress in the near term. And what we can now tell men, we have nearly 1,200 men that have gone down this pathway at UCSF, and if you look across the various cohorts that have been published, it's now many thousands, 7,000 or 8,000 at least, we can predict with it, which men are likely to need treatment within the first 3 to 5 years. And this is different from watchful waiting, which is an older concept where one would say, you've got a low-risk prostate cancer, but you also have heart disease and other problems. Go home, don't worry about this. We can give you hormonal therapy if you get symptoms of an advancing cancer in the future. Active surveillance is different. It entails a recognition that most of these cancers don't progress, but some do, and that if we see any signs of early progression, which we will detect with serial PSA assessments and repeat biopsies, we can intervene at that point with surgery, radiation, standard treatments with every intention of cure. A growing experience in the U.S. and Europe and elsewhere really suggests that this is, in most cases, quite safe and a very effective way of avoiding the potential side effects of surgery and radiation and other treatments for men with low-risk prostate cancer who, again, never really would have known that they had the disease had we not gone looking for it. Active surveillance remains relatively underused in the United States. Most publications would suggest under 10% of men with prostate cancer, and even when you look at older men with low-risk prostate cancer who are almost certainly going to die of something else long before prostate cancer, even in that situation, only about 25% of them are managed with active surveillance. Most are treated. There's many reasons for this. There's many incentives in the U.S. and elsewhere that favor treatment rather than surveillance. But as I said, I think we're increasingly realizing that this is the preferred initial strategy. And we need to do better with risk stratification. We do need to push the field for biomarkers to really try to determine which prostate cancers look low risk but might progress in the future versus which are so indolent, not only at the clinical level but also at the genetic level, that we really should not call them cancer. And we're rapidly making progress toward that goal. And our hope is that we can continue to reduce prostate cancer mortality rates while simultaneously reducing the morbidity that we have caused from overtreatment of low-risk disease. And I think if we can do that, then the screening debate really evaporates. You know, whether that message will eventually reach the Preventive Services Task Force, I don't know. But I think that you know, that goal, continuing to reduce mortality while continuing to abate overtreatment rates, really needs to be the overarching theme for ongoing research and progress in clinical management for localized prostate cancer for the coming future.
Thank you, Dr. Cooperberg, for that very comprehensive overview. Before we continue with the panelists and the discussion, I'd like to ask our panelists, Terry Herbert, Dan Hennessy, and Gary Peterson, to tell us a little bit about their own personal journeys with prostate cancer. Why don't we start with you, Terry?
Hi. Well, I'm a 16-year survivor. I was 54 years of age when I was diagnosed in 1996. I learned even then how to log onto the Internet soon after I was diagnosed and discovered that even then concern was being expressed about unnecessary treatment of men who'd been diagnosed with variants of the disease that were likely to be indolent. Doctors like Stamey and Logothetis were already saying that far too many men were having therapies that provided no benefit, but which were associated with a loss of quality of life. So I chose not to have invasive therapy, despite the advice of the doctors I consulted in Australia, the US, and South Africa, where I was living at the time. Part of my active surveillance, as I thought of it then, was to have bone scans at 5-year intervals. In 2007, the radiologist highlighted a potential lesion. Since my PSA was then 42, I reluctantly took the oncologist's advice to start intermittent ABT, androgen deprivation therapy, my latest PSA is 16. To try and help other men through this process, I established a website back in 1998, which provides basic information for newly diagnosed men and collects and shares the experience of men who've been diagnosed with cancer. We've now got over 1,000 stories on that from survivors. We get 300,000 visitors a year, and you can search the stories by diagnosis so you can find a matching story to your diagnosis.
That sounds like an excellent service. Thank you for creating that, and certainly thank you for talking about your experiences. I still believe many men, too many men, don't talk about their prostate cancer. Dan Hennessy, how about your journey?
Hey, thanks, Dan. Thanks very much. This is certainly this proves the fact that prostate cancer is not a Canadian or United States issue. It actually is a global men's health issue. And I'm certainly honored to be part of this. I started my journey with prostate cancer in 2007 at the early age of 49. After urging from my wife to go get checked, I finally listened to my wife, which most of us don't do, and had the test. And in fact, it came back that it was positive. I had a Gleason score of 6. And after the biopsy, they felt that it was probably T2 prostate cancer. My urologist at the time considered my age and my activity. I had a young child. They felt that a radical prostatectomy was the avenue to pursue, which I went through in 2007, followed up with 35 radiation treatments, because when the surgery was performed, there was a sense that it may actually have moved to a T3 length of prostate cancer. So I just want to make sure. And that was 7 years ago, and my PSA is tested quite often, and it's undetectable. And you know, it's certainly it's certainly an ongoing journey. I've had a couple of other surgeries to offset some of the potential side effects on the incontinence aspect. One actually as early as 3 weeks ago. And so it is a constant journey, a constant battle. It's a life-changing event, but it's certainly one that all men need to be aware of, and it has to be something that everybody feels comfortable in talking about.
Right, and any cancer, prostate cancer or others, are certainly life-changing events. Gary Peterson, you're not a prostate cancer survivor, but you are a myeloma survivor. Can you tell us about your story?
Yes. Actually, Priya had asked me to participate in this, and I had originally thought that, there was probably a lot of other people who might be better. However, I think that the people who have stage 4 prostate cancer are the ones that I'm probably most similar to, because they have a 5-year life expectancy of 27%. And when I started out with a dialysis-dependent kidney failure, they had indicated that I had a 3-month life expectancy. And so here I am 7 years later and still kicking after 2 stem cell transplants. But I do have cancer, and I do have a prostate, but that's about as far as I can go as being eligible to participate. But as I went through it, I had thought that there are some similarities, at least in the stage 4, and I was just shocked to find out that in stage 4 cancer, that there's twice as many people who die than with multiple myeloma, which is incurable. And as a matter of fact, the 5-year survival rate for multiple myeloma is like 37%. And I did some research on it, and I had a few questions I have for the doctor, which would help to satisfy some of my questions with regard to it, because ultimately they say everybody will end up with some level, just like the doctor had said.
Right.
So that's kind of the angle that I'm coming from.
Okay.
And I think for the stage 4 guys, they're in the same situation that I was, is that there's just no data out there as to who's good and who's not good at treating
stage 4
prostate cancer. At least I haven't found it.
Okay. Well, thank you, Gary, for sharing that. I'll start the question. Dr. Cooper, you did touch upon you did touch upon the problem of overtreatment. I hear numbers from, in the U.S. alone, we spend $2 billion in overtreatment. This week alone, I heard one that was more than 4 times that amount. It's a real question. Patients hear the word cancer and they panic. And they, the first reaction is often, I want this out of me. PSA test, I believe it's one of the best tools we have to date. I believe it saved my life and will continue to track my disease. But what new tools are coming down the line that will give patients perhaps greater assurity as they say, okay, I'm comfortable with pursuing active surveillance, or I'm okay with this mid-level treatment?
So there's a number of things in the pipeline. I think the first point, though, is to stress again that we are not bad already with the clinical information. The problem is we don't use it consistently. And like I mentioned, that there are a number of incentives, non-medical incentives, lined up against surveillance in favor of treatment. But there are, first of all, the psychological phenomenon associated with the C word, with the cancer diagnosis, is a huge part of the problem. And that's really our fault as the entire medical profession, from pathology to urology to oncology. We use the same word, cancer, for a tremendous spectrum of biology, ranging at the one side to pancreatic cancer and much more aggressive malignancies where people really do have months to live. And prostate is at the absolute other end of the spectrum, where most people diagnosed literally would have decades to live, even doing nothing about it, not even surveillance. And then even within prostate cancer, there's tremendous heterogeneity of of behavior and biology. So men with what looks like low-risk prostate cancer, we again can say with pretty good accuracy today what the behavior is likely to be, at least in the next few years. Now, there's a number of tests in late-stage development, genetic tests that can be run on prostate tissue, a variety of tests that can be run on blood samples or urine samples, and novel imaging tests, things like functional MRI, MR spectroscopy, novel PET tracers. There's a whole burgeoning field in biomarker development, and these tools will all help. I mean, none of them is going to be the silver bullet by themselves. None is going to give you a green light, red light, this needs to be treated, this one doesn't. And one of the unanswered questions with all this is, like I said, I can tell you with 75% accuracy today how this is going to behave. If I could tell you with 90% accuracy how this is going to behave, would that make the difference? Would that convince people that they do or do not need treatment? And we don't really know the answer. We actually just got a large grant from the Department of Defense to actually ask exactly that question, to build a very comprehensive risk model that will incorporate genetic information, lifestyle information like diet and smoking, two different genetic assays on the tumor, patient's germline genomics, really come up with a truly personalized risk assessment that will be able to give every patient that comes to UCSF. But the whole second part of the project is figuring out how this will actually change decision-making. Will this actually result in more men being comfortable with surveillance and avoiding treatment? And we don't really know the answers to that yet.
Right.
There's many more tools in the box.
It's very complex. I mean, we know there are, 27-plus varieties of this disease. That's something most patients don't understand as they enter into their journeys. Terry, do you have a question for Dr. Cooperberg?
Well, it was my first question was along the lines that we covered pretty well, that Dr. Cooperberg's covered, was that Dr. Jonathan Oppenheimer has been saying for years that we should call the low-risk prostate cancer is something else.
Yeah.
And his last circular letter or open letter, he suggests that we should call it prostatic tubular neogenesis because none of the words we use, tumor, cancer, or malignant, really apply to low-risk prostate cancer. And he said we should highlight the potential danger by calling it potentially malignant. Now, I wondered if we went down that route, whether that would lead to a greater movement like the Gleason migration that followed when they decided that Gleason 2s were no longer to be treated as a adenocarcinoma. If we called it by something else, would we find more people that were at a malignant disease? Would they go up to 7Bs and 8s?
Yeah, there is this controversy, and there have been a lot of labels proposed out there. Ian Thompson at UT Southwestern and Laura Esserman, who's a breast surgeon, wrote a terrific editorial in JAMA a couple years ago, proposed the term idle tumor. Other people, in bladder cancer, we have something called a papillary urothelial neoplasm of unclear malignant potential. I mean, there's a lot of these suggestions out there. I personally am supportive. I think that a change in nomenclature would be very beneficial, that you call these low-grade ones something else that would imply that it needs surveillance but avoid using the word cancer. However, that requires a tremendous consensus among not just urologists but oncologists, pathologists, policymakers. It changes, there's an incredible amount of inertia in that movement. I think it's, against that sort of a change. I think it may be a direction that we will eventually head as we get these markers online. Now, if we can tell you that not only do all the clinical features look low risk, but so do the genetics, maybe that's what it will take to start changing these labels. Jonathan Epstein, who's one of the best known prostate pathologists at Johns Hopkins, just had an editorial out in the Journal of Clinical Oncology at the end of last year addressing this question, and they were talking about a change in the way we think about the Gleason scores. They stopped short of suggesting that we stop calling the lowest grade ones cancer. But they are raising these issues. I mean, that was actually the title of the editorial, should we be calling Gleason 6 cancer?
Wow.
Yeah, we've even touched upon about that, saying, how can we take the C out of cancer, the big
right.
C. Dan Hennessy, what have you got for Dr. Cooperberg?
Well, I know in Canada, the elephant in the room has become the word PSA, and I know... This is an issue that we're trying to encourage men to talk about. We're trying to raise awareness, and then all of a sudden the word PSA becomes like the mark of death, and it's not something that people should look at. It's not something, and it has a very negative connotation. In fact, I developed a video to hopefully empower our young people to take an active role in raising awareness by talking to the men in their lives, fathers, sons, uncles, grandfathers, and encourage them to talk to their doctor. And the urologist that actually took part in it gave a call to action at the end of the video and mentioned the word PSA. And a governing body here within on the east coast of Canada, Cancer Care Nova Scotia, all of a sudden put a stop to the video going into the high schools, which was the audience that was intended, because of the word PSA and all of the controversy around PSA. Now, let's face it, PSA is a test. It's not a be-all, end-all, as you've mentioned, but it will give you an indicator of abnormalities in the prostate. So I guess the question I have is, why are we putting this elephant in the room when it is a proven test to give us at least some parameters and a starting point to start the investigative aspect of dealing with prostate cancer?
Yeah, and the answer to that question is honestly probably more political than it is scientific, and it's sad, and I need to, you know, I could talk for hours on this subject, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but to spend a couple minutes, there has always been some controversy across different guideline bodies as to what the recommendations are. The urological societies and the cancer societies generally have been supportive. The internal medicine societies have tended to be a little bit more cautious. And the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, who for better or worse are perceived as the gold standard, have always been either slightly hostile or neutral. And they generally have not made a strong statement in one direction or another. Until in 2009, they came out with a recommendation of an I, which is indeterminate, except for men over 75, for whom they recommended broadly against screening. I think it's important to recognize who is on that panel. These are some respected epidemiologists who have had, you know, very successful careers in internal medicine, looking at things like vaccination policy, things like, cardiac disease. There's not an oncologist to be found, and, you know, quite honestly, you can look at the entire membership of the task force, with one exception, they've never published in prostate cancer. And if you read their evidence review, it is a deeply, deeply flawed document. And truthfully, at the end of the day, they do not understand the data to the depth that is required. And what it really comes down to are two large trials done, one in the United States and one in Europe, the PLCO and the ERSPC. And these studies are frequently cited as providing contradictory evidence with respect to the benefits of screening, and it's just simply not true. So, you know, again, staying very brief about this, the American trial, which is the PLCO, intended to randomize men to PSA screening versus no PSA screening. The problem is there were so many logistical problems getting the study off the ground. By the time it actually launched, PSA screening had become incredibly prevalent in the United States. And if you look at the final analyses, and some of these, unfortunately, too, people tend to only read the abstract of the original paper, or they only read the New York Times headline. If you actually read some of these secondary papers and some of the details here, 79% of the men that were supposed to be in the control arm actually got their PSA checked at least once in the PLCO trial. So the only thing the PLCO trial tells us is that getting your PSA checked every year for 6 years is no better than getting it checked sometimes when you happen to show up to your primary care doctor's office, and that's certainly true. But the PLCO trial tells us absolutely nothing about whether PSA versus no PSA is beneficial. These are statements made by the authors of the PLCO trial. It's not a controversial statement. Now, the European trial, when it was originally published in 2009, these papers came out in the same issue of the New England Journal of Medicine in 2009. The European trial showed that you had about a 20 to 30% reduction in prostate cancer mortality, depending on some of the statistical adjustments that they made. But they, in the initial report, they were predicting mortality events up to 11 years after screening. And the numbers that everybody picked up on there were that you had to screen 1,400 men and treat 48 to save one life. Now, that's to save one life at 9 to 11 years of follow-up. And if you're screening a 50-year-old man, 9 or 11 years of follow-up is not in any way the relevant time frame. Okay, we're talking about, and this is one of the big challenges in prostate cancer, is we screen men decades before they would potentially die of the disease because of the nature of the disease. If you wait until you know you have it, it's far too late to cure it. But that means that you need literally decades of follow-up to make meaningful statements. And there have been some very, very careful extrapolations from the ERSPC data that suggest that if you project forward over the course of a man's lifetime, the number needed to treat actually falls substantially, something like 6 to 1. And actually, there's a Swedish study, too, which gets less press, that shows a number needed to manage, not necessarily treat everybody, of about 12 to 1. And those, so again, now recognize that those we're still treating a lot of people to avoid one death. That's even 6 to 1 means we treated 5 men who didn't need it. But you have to recognize that that compares to just about anything else that we do in preventive medicine, whether we're talking about cholesterol management, mammography, what have you. So, you know, at the end of the day, you've got a very heterogeneous group of primary care providers, because don't forget, it's not urologists that decide whether or not a man gets a PSA check in most cases. It's the primary care doctors. They hear contradictory evidence. They hear different things from different guideline organizations. And for better or worse, the Preventive Services Task Force has the perception, they have the imprimatur of the government, and they are perceived as being the most objective. I actually believe that they are not, but they have that they have the sort of stamp of governmental approval. So a lot of primary care doctors just sort of assume that they are correct, and rates of screening are falling. And it's a problem because it's completely indiscriminate. You know, we screen. So I mentioned that we don't treat very, very reliably according to risk. We also don't necessarily screen the right people. There's a great study that came out from the VA population a couple of years ago, looking at screening rates for older men in the VA. And if you look at men in their 70s in the VA population, and this is not the healthiest population in the United States. These are the veterans, most of whom have multiple medical problems in this system. You know, the rates of screening for men in their 70s was around 60%, but the healthiest men were a little bit more likely to screen than the least healthy men. When you get up to men who are over 85, and most of us would say that the only time you should check a PSA in an 85-year-old is if both of his parents bring him to the exam, you will see 30% screening rates. And what's worse is among those men over 85, the men who were most likely to get screened were the ones who had the most comorbidities, you know, the men who had the most heart disease, lung disease, et cetera, because basically their doctors were just checking a box. And every time they come in, they get 50 lab tests and the PSA is one of them. That's not the right way to use PSA screening. We should be screening, you know, young men, healthy men, and screening less frequently. If you get a, there's another, you know, again, I don't want to just get into citing too many studies, but another great study from Sweden. This was actually a terrific study where they looked at men in a city in Sweden who, in 1981, long before prostate cancer was on anybody's, long before PSA was on anybody's horizon, they just drew blood on these men and stuck it in a freezer. And the men went on and lived out their lives. About 3% of them eventually died of prostate cancer. And they went back years later, once PSA was kind of broadly available, and they ran PSAs on all these archival blood specimens. And it turned out that if you had a PSA of less than 1 at age 60 and never had another PSA screen for the rest of your life, that predicted that your likelihood of dying of prostate cancer was infinitesimally low. And that's just with a single screen. So, you know, we should be screening men at a young age, screening less often. For the men that have low PSAs, they should not necessarily get a PSA every year. But we should be screening because there are men that have aggressive prostate cancers which start young. And by the time they show up, you know, in their mid-60s and get a first PSA check, it's often too late. So there's no question we should be using the test better. And most importantly, we should be targeting treatment options. Targeting treatments appropriately to the right patients that have the higher risk tumors. So, you know, look, any of us, all of us in academic urology, sort of have the same message. The problem is, you know, no specialists, you know, oncologists, urologists, not even specialist biostatisticians, are invited to participate in these dialogues with the task force. So ultimately, you get a lot of confusion in the public, and primary care doctors either decide they're going to screen everybody or they're going to screen nobody, and increasingly, it's the latter. Unless men come in and specifically request a test, it's not even being discussed with them, and I think that's a huge disservice.
Okay, thank
sorry
you,
to be long-winded,
Dr. Cooperberg. Gary Peterson, do you have a question?
Yes, I do. At first and foremost, Dr. Cooperberg, I've certainly learned a lot from your presentation far, and I can also see that you know, there's a heck of a lot of things yet to do, and that you've got a real fight on your hand. It seems to something that seems so life-saving and something that should be done, you know, doesn't seem to have, you know, that common acceptance by everybody. But the one thing, there's a few things that I've noticed, one of which is that there's the four different stages of prostate cancer, and the National Cancer Institute states that the five-year survival for the 93% of the people who are either one through three in the staging have which means that it hasn't metastasized, that their survival is basically 100%, which
right.
I think is fantastic. And
right.
and you guys have apparently come a long way to get to this point. But if it does metastasize, the five-year rate is just 27.8%, which is really worse than the incurable cancer that I have.
Yeah.
And can't these cancers, you know, and you've talked a little bit about that, but I just... It almost seems beyond understanding why you can't find these cancers before they get to the stage four,
right? Right.
Where people die.
So you know, most of the there's multiple reasons for that. And so remember, first of all, that rate does continue to fall. The proportion of men who have incurable prostate cancer, but I mean, not all men get screened. It's only about 40 to 50%. Is a ballpark guess. Of how many men actually get PSA tests at some point in their lives. Many men never get a PSA test, and they show up with, or they get one relatively late, and by the time the prostate cancer is found, it's incurable. Now, one point I will make about stage four prostate cancer is that there's an incredible amount of progress being made here as well. We've gone from a situation where in 2004 we got the first chemotherapeutic, which was Taxotere, which had actually survival benefit. And from 2004 to 2010, really nothing happened. And in the last 3 years, we've gone from one effective drug to seven. And that number is going to continue to increase very rapidly. So the menu of options of effective and very, very promising medications for men with advanced prostate cancer continues to grow all the time. And it's a very exciting time for advanced prostate cancer as well. But obviously, as you say, the best way to manage stage four prostate cancer is to catch it before it gets to that point. And I absolutely believe that if we used screening more effectively, more broadly and more effectively, we could continue to drop that rate without increasing the over-treatment rates.
Right. Thank you, Dr.
If we used PSA more effectively.
As a stage four patient myself, I say I have great confidence that, if my PSA starts rising and then if I become treatment resistant, I see the next best thing there and the next best thing behind that.
Yeah.
In new sequences and new combinations. So, from my perspective, I think the future is pretty bright.
Yeah.
And I think that if we get better at stratifying, even using the existing tools and guiding men to proactive surveillance, they too should feel pretty confident that if they move out of proactive surveillance, that there's a lot of solutions and a lot of very effective treatments for them.
Absolutely. Well, and remember, too, that most men that move out of active surveillance, we expect to move to surgery or radiation, which we expect to be curative. The number of men, that does bring up a good point, that the million-dollar question is always, what are the odds that today we can cure this and next month or next year it will be too late, right? And that those odds are not zero, but they're extremely low. We have to be careful. The number of men that will die of prostate cancer because they went on surveillance instead of getting surgery or radiation is not zero, but it's extremely low.
Right.
And we think that the window of opportunity for cure is often probably measurable in years, if not decades.
Okay, thank you. Priya, would you like to open up the call to questions from some of our listeners at this point?
Thank you, Len. Callers, listeners, you may press 1 on your keypad if you have a question for our Cure panel. The person calling from 916-375, you may please ask a question now.
Hi, my name is Jeff McLennan. I highly respect these panelists, particularly the Canadian fellow, because I'm formerly from Montreal. Hello.
Hello.
I'm starved for hockey, but not to take up more time. I also respect Dr. Cooperberg. I am a patient at UCSF, and I was just diagnosed last week with a Gleason 6, a PSA of 3.6. They've been tracking since 2009. Gleason 6, as I mentioned, it's focal on the left side. I have decided to go with active surveillance with one of the young, excellent urologists there. I had quite a I experienced a wild time up here in the Sacramento Valley where I had about four urologists when my PSA started to accelerate. Some of them wanted to do surgery immediately, and I was not ready for the priesthood. Sorry for the pun. However, if this does begin to grow in me and the doctor wants to do treatment, mm-hmm. I'm not sure surgery or radiation is what I would choose. Being a Berkeley graduate, I do tend to stretch from the ledge. I push, but due to the morbidity, I want to be realistic, particularly in respect to the doctors and your researchers. But I'm really looking at ablation. I wanted to ask particularly Dr. Cooperberg, but others on the panel, hopefully if I could obtain ablation if this thing starts to grow.
So that is it's a great question and opens up a whole other realm of you know discussion and emerging possibilities in prostate cancer. I think you know there's a lot of interest in ablation, and just for anyone that's not familiar, the idea there is why can't we just treat the tumor and leave the rest of the prostate alone? Basically, you know, people talk about a male lumpectomy or a prostate lumpectomy or something similar to that. And the reason it's difficult is that prostate cancers don't actually grow as lumps. You know, if you look at a kidney tumor, for example, it's a little ball that grows on top of or inside the kidney, and you can see the ball very clearly on imaging. Prostate cancer tends to be more infiltrative. You get cancer cells right next to normal cells, and it can be, and many of them are not visible on imaging. So the question is what one is ablating. You can ablate the entire prostate with things like cryotherapy or HIFU, but the side effects of those procedures are no better than surgery and brachytherapy and other things. And I do want to be clear, too, by the way, that treatments have also come a long way. And we all, you know, we're very concerned with things like incontinence and erectile dysfunction. But the rates of those side effects in high-volume centers where these procedures are done routinely continue to fall all the time. And it's far, far from a certainty that those side effects will exist long-term, even after the traditional therapies. So what's needed for focal ablation is reliable imaging. We need to be able to see the cancer with an ultrasound or an MRI or something similar to know that we know where to do the ablation. We have lots of effective ways of destroying tissue. We can use cryotherapy, which is ice. We can use HIFU, which is ultrasound. We can use laser. We can use all kinds of things. The question is, do we know where to aim that blade of energy? And there's lots of – the problem is some of these technologies have really been used without a lot of careful study, particularly in Europe and in some places in the U.S., and you see some pretty bad stories out there of people that have been sold bills of goods here for these sort of unproven therapies. And there are really unscrupulous stories of companies paying urologists to take their patients to Mexico to treat them there and things like that. So we're actually actively working to open up an ablation protocol here at UCSF, which will probably be based on focal cryotherapy, but we're still working out some of those details. There's probably going to be a focal HIFU protocol opening here as well, and other academic centers around the country are developing similar protocols. And like I said, there's a lot going on in Europe and I believe in Australia as well. But there's a great deal of caveat emptor here. I really believe that these treatments for now should only be happening in the setting of clinical investigation at academic centers where the outcomes are being assessed and tracked very, very carefully, because we're still not exactly sure how it should be done and how the men should be followed after treatment.
Thank you, doctor. I'll be in line when you open up.
Sure. Stay in touch with us.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we have time for maybe two more questions.
Yes, Dan. Actually, Dr. Cooperberg, we have a participant writing in. When is repeat biopsy indicated for patients with low-grade, low-volume disease who are on active surveillance?
So typical active surveillance involves a PSA check about every 3 months, and we describe a biopsy every 1 to 2 years. Now, I think in reality that gets a little bit customized depending on the patient, how old they are, how long they've been on surveillance, and how stable things are otherwise. So, you know, everybody will get a biopsy within a year, and if there's reason to believe that the original diagnostic biopsy wasn't of high quality, we'll sometimes repeat a biopsy immediately to make sure that we haven't missed an aggressive cancer. And then almost everyone will get a biopsy at the one-year mark. And then beyond that, if the PSA is absolutely stable and it was a low-risk, low-volume cancer, we can stretch out that interval, because there is some risk with every biopsy. And our goal with the biomarker development and imaging development is to be able to say, okay, this is a low-risk prostate cancer, plus the MRI is clean and the genetics look positive, we're going to do the next biopsy in 5 years. We'll treat this more like a colonoscopy. And we're hoping to move toward that sort of paradigm pretty quickly.
Thank you, Dr. Cooperberg. There's another question. I'm 58 years old, white, male, newly diagnosed, unsure of which option to choose. T1C, Gleason, 6, PSA 4.2. Considering proton, but have a metal hip replacement, so complicate proton treatment. Help.
So actually, I mean, not having seen the details, and of course, I can't give specific advice, but, you know, assuming that the cancer was not present in multiple cores, those actually are the criteria that we would consider perfect and, you know, certainly, you know, prototypical for surveillance. Proton therapy, I do have to say, is one of the, you know, there are very few treatments that I tend to advise men to shy away from. That is actually one of them, because I think the way that has been advertised is really troublesome. It's by far the most expensive treatment for localized prostate cancer by a factor of two. It's fourfold more expensive than surgery and brachytherapy, and there's not a shred of evidence published anywhere ever that it improves any clinical benefits, that it cures more cancers or causes less sexual and urinary dysfunction than brachytherapy or other forms of radiation therapy, or at the end of the day is better than surgery. But it's advertised very heavily because it's so richly reimbursed. So, you know, there are better ways to give radiation, more cost-effective and probably effective ways to give radiation therapy. But the answer to the question, I think, you know, the short, you know, from that limited data, probably surveillance is a reasonable first approach.
Thank you, Cooperberg. There's another one. He writes, I'm at stage 4. Currently, I'm taking Zytiga. Mm-hmm. I have already done Taxotere and Provenge. What are my options after Zytiga?
So I would, that's a situation where you're actually best off most likely in an academic center where you have access to clinical trials. There is enzalutamide, which is the most recently approved medication that was previously known as MDV-3100. It comes under the trade name of Xtandi. That might be a relevant option. There's another chemotherapeutic called Jeftana. I mean, there are actually, you know, a few options, and there are clinical trials for things like alpharidin and other treatments which are coming down the pipeline in late stages of development. So, you know, presumably this person is under care of an oncologist if they've already received chemotherapy, but those are some of the medications that are worth discussing, and if they don't have access locally, they should be seen at an academic center.
Thank you. There's this lady who writes in, my boyfriend has been diagnosed with low progression type prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm.
What do I expect in the near immediate future?
So, again, it depends on the specific protocol, but if it is a low-risk cancer and the friend has opted for surveillance, hopefully very little. You know, the PSA tends to be stable in the short term. Sometimes, you know, and it really depends on what we get a lot of information in the first year. If the PSA is really rising steadily, and it really has to be steady. Sometimes the PSA will blip up and then come right back down again, and we always are careful not to panic over single PSA values. If the PSA is rising steadily and rapidly, if the repeat biopsy shows higher grade cancer, you know, that's one that needs to be treated. But if the PSA is stable or even declining, if the repeat biopsy is negative, which it sometimes is, it doesn't mean the cancer went away, but it means it was so small that we couldn't even find it the second time. You know, those are signs that this is one that is likely not to progress in the short to intermediate term. So it really sort of depends what happens in the first year or two of observation, I think.
Thank you, Doctor. I have a few questions for you. My first one would be, when would a physician tell a patient who's on watchful waiting to undergo primary treatment?
Yeah, so there's not an easy answer there. Generally, so the criteria that we use, I would say steadily rising PSA, and there's not a strict line. It's not like you're fine when your PSA is 9.7, when it's 10.1, you need to be treated. I think it's when there's signs of a steady rise in the PSA, and if there's a sign of real progression, either on imaging or on biopsy. You know, I think we're increasingly comfortable with the idea that if you go from a 3+3 to a 3+4 with just a minimal volume of pattern 4, sometimes those men can stay on surveillance, but that is, you know, in other places that's often a trigger for treatment. The men that we see clearly go from 1 core positive to 7 cores positive. We see multiple cores of 3+4. any 4+3, you know, real change in aggressiveness, those certainly are cancers that should be treated immediately. And then there's a lot that are gray areas, and there honestly is a lot of, you know, the sort of art of medicine rather than kind of science and hard lines here. And it's always an ongoing discussion with the patients. There are patients that are, you know, there are men that you know, really had to be talked into surveillance in the first place because they can't stand the C word, and those men tend to want to be treated at a lower threshold. There's other men that really will do anything possible to avoid surgery and radiation, and they're much more comfortable letting things ride. So it's always very individualized.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cooperberg. I think that was a wonderful discussion. We are almost coming to the end of our show time.
Okay.
Dr. Cooperberg, thank you very much. It was an honor to have you here today.
Terry
Herbert, Dan Hennessy, and Gary Peterson, it was a pleasure to have you on the Cure Panel Talk Show. Thank you very much. Dan, it was a wonderful discussion. Thank you for co-hosting it with us. Cure Talk thanks all its listeners and participants. Thank you all for your support, and we look forward to having all of you join us for the next Cure Panel Talk Show. For more details of our upcoming shows, please visit trilex.com/curetalk. Thank you. Thank you very much. It was great having you here.